ॐ नमो भगवते
वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते
वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th Canto, Chapter 2, Prayers by the Demigods, Text 21.
Kim Ajya Tasmin Karaniyam Asyume Yad Artha Tantra Na Dahanti Vikramam Striya Sasur Guru Machavadoyam Yasastriya Mahanchanu Kalamayu Translation. Comes a thought. What is my duty now? The Supreme Lord, who knows His purpose, Puritanaya Sajunam Vinashaya Chadushkritam, will not give up His prowess. Devaki is a woman. She is my sister. And moreover, she is pregnant. If I kill her, my reputation, opulence, and duration of life will certainly be vanquished. Purport. According to Vedic principles, a woman, a brahmana, an old man, a child, and a cow should never be killed. It appears that Kamsa, although a great enemy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was aware of Vedic culture and conscious of the fact that the soul transmigrates from one body to another, and that one suffers in the next life according to the karmas of this life. Therefore, he was afraid of killing Devaki. Since she was a woman, she was his sister, and she was pregnant. A Kshatriya becomes famous by performing heroic acts. But what would be heroic about killing a woman who, while confined in his custody, was under his shelter? Therefore, he did not want to act drastically by killing Devaki. Kamsa's enemy was within Devaki's womb. But killing an enemy in such a nascent state would not be an exhibition of prowess. According to the Kshatriya rules, an enemy should be fought face to face and with proper weapons. Then if the enemy is killed, the victor becomes famous. Kamsa was very conscientiously deliberating upon these facts and therefore refrained from killing Devaki, although he was completely confident that his enemy had already appeared within her womb. Translation again. Kamsa thought, what is my duty now? The Supreme Lord, who knows His purpose, Puritanaya Sajunam Vinashaya Chadushkritam, will not give up His prowess. Devaki is a woman. She is my sister. And moreover, she is now pregnant. If I kill her, my reputation, opulence, and duration of life will certainly be vanquished. Om Agyanatirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare All the possible interests and tastes that you want to have are there in Srimad Bhagavatam. Mm. The living entity cannot live without taste and flavor. Our sojourn through material existence is one of a quest for tastes and flavors. We seek these tastes and flavors
in our relationships with others, in our relationships with other things. This is what life is all about. Whether in the spiritual world or in the material world, the living entity is always interacting with tastes and flavors. Srimad Bhagavatam is acquainting you with the flavors of the spiritual world. Therefore, it is so important that devotees daily bathe in Srimad Bhagavatam, because in this way, their life becomes moistened and eventually drowned by coming in contact with the transcendental nectar of Srimad Bhagavatam. Sanatana Goswami says that every syllable of Srimad Bhagavatam is saturated with Krishna praying. People want to experience God. Daily, you can contact God directly as Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, in the mundane sphere, in the material world, people are attracted to murder stories, romance stories, action stories, suspense stories. That is all there in Srimad Bhagavatam. But everything in Bhagavatam is directly in relationship to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is the spotless Purana, Amala Purana, meaning there's not one touch of any other desire than pure service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Bhagavatam is beyond mere dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. It is beyond religiosity. It is beyond economic development, sense gratification, and it is even beyond liberation from the material world. So all the different histories, accounts, and flavors that Bhagavatam presents directly put you in connection with Krishna. Now just see what's going on in this verse. You're hearing the thoughts of a murderer. You're hearing the thoughts of one of the greatest brutes in the history of this world. Of course, in the past century, there were famous demons, famous brutes. Sometimes there are debates among historians. Who was the greatest brute of the 20th century? Was it Stalin, who killed maybe 20 million of his own people? His secret police were so efficient. They were proud of their duties. They said, his main man, his henchman said, if we haven't yet brought you to court and put you in jail, it's because we haven't been doing our job. That's the only reason why you're not in jail. We haven't been doing our job. He also said, show me a man, I'll show you a case. So, in this way, millions upon millions, the estimate is there are 20 million people, his own people, Russians, were killed by starvation, by prison camps. And then, of course, there's Hitler. And then, recently, this person in Cambodia, this is in the past 25 years. Cambodia is a small country, yet this person, he arranged for millions of people to die through starvation, just to show his theories, just to practice his twisted notions. Now, Kamsa is far powerful than any of these demons of the 20th century. He's so powerful that the Yadu dynasty has fled. The Yadus were even hiding in caves. They had gone to distant kingdoms because of Kamsa. But not all the devas had fled. Some of them stayed around Kamsa, like Akura. Why is that? Because they wanted a ringside seat when Krishna would kill Kamsa. They knew
Yeah. The best way to see all the action is if we're around Kamsa. We know Krishna's going to kill him, so we'll act like we're part of Kamsa's party just so we can see firsthand from close up the Supreme Lord annihilate him. This is how ferocious Kamsa was. Only Krishna could kill him. He was a specially empowered demon who had been killed by Krishna in his previous life. But still, he would not give up in his quest. So now, as we said, you're hearing the thoughts of this murderer. The thoughts of this person who would order the killing of children throughout the whole region just to see if Krishna might be one of them. In other words, just kill all the children and somehow or other Krishna will be amongst them and he'll be dead. We don't know which one for sure is Krishna, but if we just kill all the children, we're sure to get the job done. Mrs. Kamsa. Now, you hear what he's thinking. He's in a common predicament in the material world. Circumstances are pushing you, and then you wonder, what is my duty? What should I do? Many of you can remember being in circumstances like this. Bewildering circumstances, pressing circumstances, excruciating circumstances, painful. What am I going to do? What do I do now? We like to forget those times, but that is the nature of material existence. We like to hope that our material life will proceed very nicely and orderly, but no, there's no possibility of peace on the material platform. Just like nations today hope that simply by economic cooperation there's going to be world peace. It will not happen. Economic development means passion. And passion always becomes frustrated, and then there's anger. And when there's anger, then there's fighting. For no reason at all. You can study international relations at the university decade after decade. Why was there this war? How can we avoid it the next time? You can do that all your life, and still there's going to be war. Just like you can study economics all your life, how to distribute the wealth fairly, how everyone can have prosperity. You can study that until you're dead in your grave or cremated as ashes. Still, there'll be a class of persons who are poor. That's just the way this world is. There must be war. There must be poverty. This is the arrangement of karma. So when will we understand that the most intelligent thing to do with my life is to get rid of karma, get rid of my karmic reactions? Then, and only then, can there be real freedom. The Krishna consciousness movement is meant to get rid of death. Death means karmic reaction. It's the ultimate karmic reaction. At the time of death, all your plans are thrown out the window. You might have thought, I'll have a nice long life, I'll enjoy relationships that I've established. These relationships will go deeper and deeper. I'll become more expert at doing things in this world. I'll finally understand my computer and my mobile, how to use it. Yeah. You have all these plans how you'll continue on and your life will increase. Your life will become enriched. It'll become more knowledgeable and more expert. You'll become more adept at personal relationships. All these plans are in your head, how you shall live for the duration. But at any moment, the ultimate karmic reaction, death can come. The purpose of this Krishna consciousness movement is to stop death. Now, why isn't anyone thinking that, yes, this is my real career, to make a solution to the death problem? Because of death, we have fear. Many people will say, oh, I'm not afraid of death. If it happens, it happens. But as soon as that death call comes, then you see they're shaking, they're in such distress. His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj was telling me a story about a man in Chicago. Very wealthy man. He became a multimillionaire just by manufacturing pizza dough. A businessman, he can make profit in any way, even by opening up a pizza dough factory. So he became the monopoly for Chicago, the city of Chicago, for supplying pizza dough to all the pizzerias and restaurants and like that. He's making millions of dollars. Now he's about 70 years old, and he has the perfect program for material happiness, as he sees it. Every 2 years, he marries a different young woman in her 20s. And he tells his accountant that, you budget for me, that every 2 years I'm going to have to spend, you know, maybe $500,000 in alimony, divorce settlement. I know these young girls are just marrying me for my money. And I know they'll marry me, and then after a couple of years, they'll want to divorce me. That's all right. They're getting what they want. I'm getting what I want from them. So you just budget in your accounts that every 2 years I'm going to have to spend $500,000 for, you know, except for divorce expenses and maintaining the life. It's all right. You just budget it. And then he was diagnosed with cancer, 1 year to live, and oh, he just became completely ghostly, haunted, morose. Just, what am I going to do now? Just like comes to saying, what is my duty now? Comes to saying, the Supreme Lord, who knows his purpose, will not give up his prowess. Similarly, death knows its purpose. It will not stop. So this man, all his millions of dollars will not save him. He lives in a big penthouse on top of a building in the middle of Chicago. Nothing will stop the onslaught of death. And so therefore he's like a deranged man. Oh, powerless. What can he do? I was just reading a statement by probably the third richest man in the world. Right behind the Microsoft man. It's the Sun man. And he's just proudly presenting himself. I am a very happy man. I'm a very happy man. I'm worth $23 billion. That is real happiness, and I recommend it to everyone. I can have whatever I want. Yachts, airplanes. Why an airplane? An airport or three? Houses here and there, mansions. I can have everything I want. I recommend this to everyone. I heartily recommend it. I'm a very happy man. What kind of happiness is this? That in a second it can all be finished. Outside of his control, that so-called happiness, as the song Bhaja Hare Mana says, that so-called happiness is like a drop of water on the petal of a lotus flower. At any moment, that drop of water can fall off. But he says, I'm so happy. I recommend this to everyone. Actually, if you know these people, these wealthy people, extraordinarily wealthy people, you'll find they're so lonely. They're empty inside, and they're very envious. Just like the Sun man can't tolerate that he's not as wealthy as the Microsoft man. He can't tolerate it. Or is it the Sun man or the Oracle man? It's the Oracle man, yes. He can't tolerate it that he's not as wealthy as the Microsoft man. Why is the Microsoft man getting all the attention? I've also done so much with my Oracle system. Why does the other one get all the attention? Therefore, he has to push himself forward. I am happy. I have so much. I can get whatever I want. Can't you see? I'm happy. I recommend it to you. Of course, if you would look at this person's personal life, you would see such despair, such emptiness, because money cannot purchase fulfillment and inner contentment.
How long will it take for people to understand that? Very wealthy people like that. They like to purchase yachts, millions of dollars. It's part of the lifestyle that you have a yacht and you cruise the seas. So the yacht makers say that the real thrill in owning a yacht is not sailing in it, but ordering the yacht. The wealthy people come to the yacht makers, and the yacht makers sit them down and say, "Tell us your dreams. What would you like on this yacht? Just think of anything." The Oracle man wanted a full basketball court on his yacht. So the yacht makers, "Yes, yes, we can do it for you. Tell us your dreams. What do you want? A complete fitness center, a complete basketball court, a huge gambling casino on your yacht? Yes, we can arrange it. Tell us. Just think, sit in this chair and dream, and we'll make it happen for you." So the yacht makers say that this is the greatest part of the experience for these people. Not owning the yacht or sailing in it, but just sitting in the chair and just dreaming, "I want this, I want that." And then the yacht people say, "Yes, yes, we'll do it for you. That'll be $5 million only." This gives you insight into how people enjoy. They try to enjoy. It's mainly in the mind. In fact, the yacht makers say that the pleasure of planning out your own yacht is so much more intense than actually sailing in the yacht that many wealthy people, after the first yacht, get another and another just to go through the experience of dreaming and saying, "I want this, I want that." So then they have a yacht for the Caribbean, a yacht for the Atlantic, a yacht for the Pacific, a yacht for the Baltic. And the main thing that they're attached to is just that, "Let me have a basketball court on my yacht. Let me have a Mexican restaurant on my yacht." And the yacht maker's saying, go on, dream, dream, tell us, we'll do it. Whatever you want, just tell us." That is the actual luxury of the situation. What does that show you? That the so-called pleasure of sense gratification is actually just in the planning, the mental phase. It's all in the mind. The mental image of sense gratification cannot compare to the actual activity. In your mind, you can imagine you are the supreme. That is the benediction of Maya upon you. In your mind, you can imagine it, but in actuality, you must surrender to time and death. Now, you might say, "Well, look, if I was as wealthy as the number three man, the Oracle man, you know, okay, it's all temporary, but look what he has. He can get whatever he wants." Do you understand, though, that when those kind of persons meet time in the form of disease, old age, and death, they become the craziest? They suffer more than anyone because they've been so attached, they've been so ignorant in the Bhavi conception of life, they become so absorbed in their own so-called power that when time shows who's really in control, they become mad. They scream, they yell, "Doctor, I'm paying you $2 million. Why can't you stop this disease? Haven't you checked the latest medical research and do something?" They become the most crazy at the time of death. So, what is the use of having a few moments of so-called pleasure which simply brings about such intense suffering? Because attachment produces suffering. When will we understand that? You know, the so-called pleasure of becoming attached, it seems kind of nice. Doesn't Maya make it seem kind of nice to become attached to something? Whether it's a person or a thing, you get a new mobile phone. "Wow, this is my phone. Oh, let me try this, let me try that. Take pictures with it." This is the kind of thing men are into. The ladies aren't so much into these things. But it's yours to be attached to. Whether it's a person, your home, or your cell phone, or your computer, or your car, or your set of cosmetics, it's yours to play with.
And then it seems like it's so nice to be attached.
Me and mine. My world, my attachments.
But all those attachments always bring suffering. This is the riddle of material existence. What seems to look to be so attractive causes your undoing, your misery. Srila Prabhupada gives a very nice example about the ocean. When you're standing on the shore, the waves of the ocean look very nice. And you remember standing on the shore watching the waves of the ocean. But although they look nice from where you are, if you actually go deep into the ocean where the waves are, you'll be in extraordinary difficulty. This is the nature of Maya. When you're not in Maya, Maya looks attractive. Oh, look. Look at those waves. As soon as you go in the waves, you're in complete difficulty. So you have to learn how to not be fooled. Don't let your sense perception fool you. Understand with knowledge that the waves are very ferocious. Although they look nice and inviting from a distance, once you get in them, your life is completely turned upside down. So here is Kamsa in a very excruciatingly painful situation. What is my duty now? What should I do? As I said, you can remember. Everyone has that moment in life. Several moments. Many moments when, what to do? Oh no, I don't see any way out of this. The material energy presses everyone. You feel like that. You're caught in a vice and you're being pressed. Like you're a grape in some kind of wine press. You feel that way. What is my duty? What to do? Now, Kamsa is calculating. Ordinarily, he's thinking, I would kill this person. But how can I do it? She's a woman. I thought of killing her before. I almost did it. Vasudev stopped me with a good deal that he would bring me all the children born of this woman. Now here she is. She's pregnant. I can see that Krishna is within her. You see, Kamsa could notice the effects of Krishna consciousness. But he's anti-Krishna. As you heard in the verse yesterday, he saw Shuchi Smita. He saw her brilliant smile. The whole room had become effulgent. She was jubilant. Kamsa knew she's Krishna conscious. Krishna is within her. She's never looked like this before. This shows you that even non-devotees can notice the effects of Krishna consciousness, but they become very afraid by it. I remember when I was coming to Krishna consciousness, I never told my best friend, my mate, that I was delving into Krishna consciousness. But he picked it up without me saying anything. One day he came to me and said, "What's come over you? You're not the same anymore. I'm going to have to find a new mate. I mean, something's just happened to you." So Kamsa, he notices, what's going on with Devaki? Krishna must be there. She's never looked like this before. He could see the effects of bhakti. And certainly the devotees can see the effects of bhakti. These effects are described in the 11th canto. Bhakti prashanu bhavo pratyaya anyatra cha. The verse compares the three effects of devotional service to the Lord with the three effects from eating a nice meal. Very practical example. When you eat a nice meal, you get tushti, pleasurable satisfaction. And you also get nourishment. Strength that you get from the food nourishes your body. And you also get shuddhapaya, cessation of the hunger pangs. So remember those three things. Pleasurable satisfaction from eating, nourishment and relief from the pangs of hunger. Now, what does bhakti do? What are the effects of bhakti compared to eating? Devotion gives you pleasure. The taste of serving Krishna is satisfying, just like good food is satisfying. And devotional service to the Lord gives you direct experience of the Lord. That direct experience of the Lord nourishes your spiritual life. So from devotional service, you get pleasure because bhakti is tasty, and you get nourishment because the direct experience of the Lord strengthens, enlivens your spiritual life. And then also, devotional service to the Lord, bhakti, gives you relief from hankering. The pangs of material desire are relieved. Just like when you eat, your hunger pangs go away. Similarly, when you render transcendental loving service to the Lord, your material desires go away. Sometimes you become so astonished. What's happened to me? I know even sometimes some devotees feel uncomfortable that their material desires have disappeared. And certainly your former material acquaintances, they feel uncomfortable, many of them. What's happening to you? I don't feel that you have hankering anymore. I don't feel that you're materially greedy anymore. Where's your lust? Where's your anger? You're not a proper human being anymore. The effects of Krishna consciousness can be felt even in the beginning stages of bhakti. This is stated by Jiva Goswami in his purports to this verse in the 11th canto. You, even in the stage of sadhana, when you're following the rules and regulations of devotional service, you can perceive the ultimate result. Now, you may not feel that you have the ultimate result completely, but you can perceive it. From the very beginning, you can see what's coming at the end of the road. That is the amazing thing about Krishna consciousness. Whereas in material life, you think you see what the result will be. I'll work hard, I'll get a promotion, I'll rise on the corporate ladder. You think it's all so clear ahead of you. And then what happens? Downsizing time. What you thought you saw so clearly was not there. Who is it? Your old acquaintance, Budi Mantak, was telling me how it's done before he left Australia for India. The company, the corporation, they wait until Friday, and then you come to work on Friday. You've been doing the job for 30 years. And you come Friday and there's a note on your desk. And they ask you, please, you have 30 minutes to depart. Why did they tell you that? Because they're afraid if you don't get out immediately, you'll take revenge and destroy their whole computer system. So they give you a note, okay, you're terminated. We're sorry, and please clear out in 30 minutes. And they're afraid. This is material life. We're afraid. This guy knows so much about our IT. You know, he can get into our system and just sink the whole thing. Get him out quickly. This is a person who's worked there 20, 30 years. So the company does it on Friday so that the weekend will come and all the other employees will forget about it by the time Monday comes. They'll get drunk and Kali Yuga, so-called delights. But so there's some time for there to be forgetfulness. So it's done on Friday. Often, the man is so devastated, the company has to have someone drive him home. You can just imagine, after 20 years of work, you come in one, you say goodbye to your family, bye love, bye kids, going to work, drive away. And then you have to come right back. And probably your kids haven't left for school yet, your wife hasn't left for her job yet, and you're coming back.
I have no job. How will we make our mortgage payments? How will we pay for our children's university? I have no job.
You staked your whole life on rising in the corporate ladder. You gave your all in all. You surrendered to the IT diva.
And then, without practically a moment's notice, you're kicked out the door. You and all your skills, out the window.
And you feel so shattered. Wait a minute, I'm a skilled person. I'm a knowledgeable person. I'm a technologist. You can't do this to me. I gave my all. I came weekends when you needed me. I stayed up all night solving your IT problems. And you can't treat me like this. That's the feeling. How can you treat me like this? It's not fair.
And of course, what do they always tell you? Who said life is fair? The company must become profitable, so you have to go. We have to please our shareholders.
So often, these corporate executives, they're shattered. They're crying. It's 9 a.m. in the morning, and they've just shown up for work, and they're given a half hour to clear out your office and get out. And they have to have someone else drive them home. They're such emotional wrecks. What they saw so clearly, success, prestige, position, was an illusion. It vanishes so quickly. But in bhakti, what you see, that ultimate goal that you see, that is for real. And even though you're not on that platform, you can still see that ultimate goal and gradually make progress towards it. This is the amazing thing about sadhana bhakti. You don't have the spontaneous attraction for the Supreme Lord yet, but you can see the goal clearly, and the goal can be attained. The more you progress in the rules and regulations of devotional service, the more you become in contact with the ultimate goal, and you become jubilant, knowing it's not an illusion, it's not a superstition, it's not just a religious belief.
Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the original.
Now, one final example that the Goswamis give in the purport to this verse, Bhakti Preshanu Bhavo Bharaktya Anyatra Cha. They say that the example comparing bhakti to a meal is not completely tight. Because what happens when you eat? When you eat, you become so absorbed in what you're relishing that everything else around you just disappears seemingly. Bhakti does that also. When you're absorbed in devotional service to the Lord, the material world goes away. You've all had that experience, even in the beginning of bhakti. and you become satiated, you lose interest. Okay, I've had enough. Even the servers come, oh, I keep trying to put something more on your plate. No. I'm satisfied, you're saying. Basically, you're saying I've lost interest because my satisfaction makes me lose interest. But that is not the way of bhakti. The more you feast on bhakti, the more your appetite increases, even though you're not feeling material pangs anymore. Your spiritual appetite increases. Let us remember that. Bhakti yoga increases your hunger for Krishna. This is what we want to feel, an appetite for Krishna, a healthy hunger. Let me engage everything in the service of the Lord. That is real spiritual life, not just religious belief, dharma, artha, kama, moksha. No. Lord Chaitanya says, prema, pumartha, mahan. Love of God, Krishna prema, is in the fifth dimension, beyond dharma, artha, kama, moksha. In that fifth dimension of loving Krishna, or even just practicing in sadhana to love Krishna, you develop this hunger more and more. Let me engage the world in Krishna's service. And that appetite increases. There's no limit. These are the effects of bhakti. And Kamsa's noticing. Look at Devaki. She must have Krishna within her. Now, he's calculating. She's got Krishna within her. What is my duty? How devious can I get? She's a woman. Okay. I didn't hesitate to kill a woman before, but now it's a bit too much. She's pregnant. In other words, Kamsa is calculating. Normally I do all kinds of abominable things, but this is just too much, killing a pregnant woman. You see, he's actually thinking about it. He's calculating. This is how abominable he is. Well, it's not so good to kill a pregnant woman. What would my reputation be? It's not that he's feeling religious. It's not that he's motivated by dharma. He's motivated by fear. Me and mine. How will it look to others if I kill a pregnant woman? I would have killed her before just as a woman. But she's pregnant with a child. That's too much for my reputation. That's how he's thinking. This is not religion. This is just what makes me look good. What makes me feel good. When there's a complete absence of understanding what is dharma, people make their decisions in this way. What makes me feel good? What feels right for me? And almost the whole world will applaud you if you do like that these days. Right? Try it. Just start telling people, you know, I'm just doing what feels right for me. Everyone nodded. You have reached the pinnacle of human civilization. You know, others may not like this. It may not be good for them. But for me, this feels like the right thing. Everyone nods their head. It's my life. I have to make my decision. That is total irreligion. Real religion, real dharma means, what does Krishna want? What does the Shastra say? Let me do that. Then, and only then, do you have human civilization. And that kind of thought process is there. But right now, everyone is thinking like Kamsa. What's the best for me and mine? They're for ladies? Sure. If they are pregnant and they don't want to have the child, it's my body. I'll do what I like. I'll kill the child. Why not? It's my choice. My decision. How dare you make that decision for me? If I feel like doing this, I'll do it. And you do what you feel. And then there'll be world peace. And now the demons think. World peace comes about when everyone does whatever they feel. And this is going on all over the world, and now you see the result. It's like in Ukraine. This is actually the biggest country in Europe. The people are contesting the election. The people in the east of Ukraine wanted one candidate. The people in the west of Ukraine wanted the other candidate. So now they're talking. Either our candidate is declared the winner of the election, or we split the country. Each side feels right. This must be done. When there's no dharma controlling the situation, then how can there be peace? Everyone will just do exactly what they feel and calculate like Kamsa, and under the modes of nature, they'll do so many abominable things. It seems right.
Yes.
Let me do this to protect myself. Let me do that to further my interests. Everyone is thinking like Kamsa these days. No one has understanding of what is dharma. No one understands their responsibility that the human form of life gives them. Everyone is just calculating based on their selfish interests. Well, this will be good for my reputation. No, I don't think I'll do that. I would, but I can't get away with it. People will think badly of me, therefore I won't do it. That is so-called religion of today. This is thinking like Kamsa. Kamsa's thinking process has become global now. The world global culture is the Kamsa culture. What's in it for me? How do I feel? How can I advance my own interests? The Krishna conscious lifestyle is completely different. The effects of the Krishna conscious lifestyle are completely different. So in this encounter between Kamsa and Devaki, you're seeing the difference between the demoniac life and the Krishna conscious life. It is not a difference just of belief, it is a difference in fact, in reality. All right, any questions?
Yes.
Sometimes we might find that catch ourselves thinking like ourselves, but is there anything we can do?
That's why it's necessary to study the Shastra and with a mood to apply it in your life. Otherwise, yes, the Kali Yuga thinking processes will become topmost in your life. What's in it for me? Me and mine. Instead, you study the Shastra so that you understand I have a responsibility as a human being to follow Dharma. And in that way, I'll obtain the result of Dharma, which is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Following Dharma with no intent to gain the association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is not the most important thing. But when you follow religious principles for the sake of pleasing the Supreme Lord, then your life becomes successful. Therefore, it's very important in this horrible Kali Yuga that devotees regularly bathe their minds, their thinking processes, in the Shastra. Otherwise, you'll just think Krishna consciousness is a religious belief. Prabhupada's books teach you how to think properly. They clean your brain. And gradually, instead of a Kali Yuga brain, you have the intelligence of the Shastra working for you. Then your life becomes successful. So you're right. It's natural, from the material point of view, that we slip back into the Kamsa consciousness. What is my duty now? What is the best thing for my selfish interests? It's me and mine. If you think through the Shastra, make your life's decisions based on the Shastra, you'll be safe from that Kali Yuga disease thinking process. Yeah?
But the devotee doesn't finish his Krishna Raja's class in the life.
Mm-hmm.
So why does Krishna send that to the demons?
You can go to the heavenly planets. It's up to Krishna. You can take birth on this earth again in a family of devotees. If you go to the heavenly planets, you'll be with devotees and you can make further progress there and go to Krishna Lila from there. It's possible. Still, you'll notice in the fifth canto, the demigods talk about life on the heavenly planets. They say, it's too intense here. The happiness is too intense. If we have any pious activities left, when we expend our time in the heavenly planets, we want to be born on earth. And particularly, we want to be born in Bharat. There we'll easily, in a short life, be able to become Krishna conscious and go back to God. Devotional service is the best pious activity. It's not a pious activity, but looked at from the punya point of view, it's the best punya. So therefore, you attain the heavenly planets from punya, but what better punya can there be than bhakti? So you may go to the heavenly planets and there make further progress, and from the heavenly planets you can join Krishna Lila. Or Krishna may decide that better you take birth on earth again and preach Krishna consciousness. It's up to Krishna. At best, at the time of death, the devotee prays, my dear Lord, take me wherever you like, but never let me forget your service. Yeah?
In the spiritual world, there are no demons, and the demons are made here. In the material universe, for the Lord's pleasure. And no matter how heinous or what they have done, they're always liberated by the Lord and they merge in the Lord's conscience. So it's very difficult to understand that this happens to the most horrible demons, and what hope is there for us?
There's great hope, because if the demons who are killed by the Lord attain his effulgence, what do you think the bhaktas are going to get? If the demons get the effulgence and they're anti-Krishna, obviously the bhaktas will get even better. The bhaktas will get to play with Krishna in the pastures, hear Krishna's flute and run to meet him in the middle of the night. The bhaktas will get to nurse Krishna. They'll get to gossip about Krishna, how Krishna and Balaram are stealing milk products in the village. So yes, by the example of the demons being killed by the Lord and attaining the effulgence, it lets you know the bhaktas, the devotees of the Lord, who can understand their reward. Brahma, he himself expressed amazement by this. He says in the 14th chapter of Bhagavatam, my dear Lord, you are the embodiment of all benedictions. My mind is totally boggled thinking, how could there be any other reward than you? You've given yourself to Putana, this witch, this Rakshasi. So what is left of you to give to the Brijvasis? My mind is totally amazed. So yes, Krishna is giving himself to demons who try to kill him. Even giving, merging into the Brahmana effulgence lets you know that if the demons are going to get that, who can estimate what the devotees will get? Anything else? Yes. Those things, grave and jolly, are not, they don't cancel each other out in Krishna consciousness. A devotee is grave and serious about achieving the mission of human life. But while executing that grave mission, you're very jolly. While executing that very serious mission, you're jolly. What makes people morose? What do you think? Selfishness is a morose life. You see, this whole so-called culture of today teaches people how to be selfish. Selfishness simply makes you miserable. When you see devotees who are morose, you should know that they're selfish. That's the only reason. Me and mine. What's going to happen for me? No one's paying enough attention to me. What about me and my program? Is it about time Krishna took notice of me and gave me what I wanted? You become very morose that way. And as soon as you start thinking, let me be expansive, let me work for the betterment of Krishna's pleasure, let me distribute Krishna to others, you become happy. Very simple. Sometimes our devotees forget and become locked into this me and mine mentality. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. I did that before. Been there, done that. You know, devotional service. They become morose. As soon as you start to become giving again, what can I do for the betterment of others? The best way to act for the betterment of others is to become Krishna conscious and work for the Krishna consciousness of others. You become joyful. You become lighthearted. We see the difference all the time. It's always very simple how to escape moroseness. Moroseness means selfishness. It's miserable just thinking about your mind and senses all day long. You ever tried it? It's completely miserable. How am I feeling? Why did you do this to me? Why didn't you do that to me? I need this. I want that. All day long meditating. My mind, my body, my mind, my body, my mind, my body. It's miserable. And as soon as you think how to give Krishna to others, how to engage everything in Krishna's service, you become so lighthearted and happy. Okay? Yes.
You mentioned that Kamsa was considering his own reputation in order to do something wrong. So I find myself in certain situations if I don't want to, and there's something wrong which maybe I'm planning to do, but then I consider maybe the Shastra is saying not to do, and the Supa Soul is also watching. But most of the time, the fear of other devotees maybe saying or considering that fact stops me. So is it like worldly concept?
No, that's good. That's good. That's a reason to associate with devotees. They become your moral conscience. That's good.
What will the devotees think?
That's nice. That's why we have a society of devotees, to protect you. Very good. And then gradually, in the association of devotees, you'll start thinking, if I do this, Krishna will not be pleased. It'll ruin my ability to love Krishna. Forget it. Alright, thank you very much. Glory to Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare.